Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We are watching the national discussion on race motivated by the issues before the NBA right now. Later this hour, what the NBA must do to get past the Sterling nightmare for the LA Clippers. We'd love to know what you think about all of this. A story, please. Call us at 877-8MY-TAKE or join the conversation at thetakeaway.org. But first, a big constitutional issue you can put in your pocket. How much charge do you have in your cell phone right now? All charged up? How's the memory? Nearly empty? Nearly full? What if I streamed all of the data on your phone to one of the HD billboards in the middle of Times Square for the entire universe to see? Huh? You fine with that? Yeah, your entire secret Nickelback playlist up there on display, all the pictures, the search history, the calls, the texts, the who and the where. I could put a map of where you have been for the last 2 weeks up there on the billboard and retrace your steps. Now, what if it is the government that wants to see your smartphone? Everything. Are you all fine with that? Our fabulous smartphone technology is so smart that users can forget that the lovely devices are really just collecting evidence on all of us. Criminals, citizens, celebrities. What does that mean in a free society? Pop star Chris Brown's cell phone data incriminated him as unfaithful, but it was his own behavior toward his girlfriend Rihanna that made him into a criminal. But he's hardly the only person with a cell phone information problem. Cell phones have been used in terrorism. The NSA watches smartphones to prevent terrorism. Smartphone data has become so important to criminal enterprises, according to law enforcement, that urban gangs are believed to have IT departments these days. More about that in just a moment. The digital space was already challenging the constitutional notions of privacy and government search and seizure before smartphones. Today, the Supreme Court is being asked to decide what the government relationship to your smartphone is or should be. Do police need a warrant before searching the smartphone of a person under arrest? Someone who has a big interest in this case before the court is the police commissioner of the city of Philadelphia, Charles Ramsey. He's also the president of the Major Cities Chiefs of Police Association. That organization has filed a friend of the court brief arguing that the government has a compelling interest to search cell phones in criminal cases. Commissioner Ramsey explained how vital he believes smartphone data is right now and how technology is rapidly making the traditional doctrine behind search warrants, he believes, obsolete.
Well, it represents information of a crime, whether it's video, whether it's phone numbers, text messages, whatever. It is technology that we have to deal with on a regular basis now in today's world. I realize that there's personal information in smartphones, but when we do make an arrest, it is very, very important that we be able to have access to information that would lead us to a criminal conviction in a particular case.
Would you accept any restrictions on access to that information, or if you just have the cell phone in your hand, basically it's open season?
Well, the real issue is these smartphones, because data can be removed remotely. So if a person is in custody, and we've had situations already, Orange County, California, for an example, the sheriff's office there conducted a raid of a narcotic organization and money laundering organization. And others got wind of the fact that the arrests were going down and remotely erased all information from cell phones of every member of that organization. In fact, that particular drug organization had its own IT department that was capable of doing just that. Now, obviously, there was an awful lot of evidence that was lost as a result of that. All we're trying to do is make the court aware of the fact that waiting to get a warrant is not always practical. And during that period of time when you're waiting, which is what happened in Houston, Texas, in another case involving a prostitute and a pimp, while they were waiting for the warrant, the evidence on that phone was erased. So we're hopeful that the court will take today's technology into consideration when making their decision.
Isn't it possible, though, that obstruction of justice and evidence tampering and evidence destruction laws cover the deletion of a cell phone, and that you could go after people for obstruction of justice, for reformatting their smartphone?
Well, you know, we've got something now that we've been working on, something called a kill switch. If your phone is stolen or otherwise lost, where you can erase information on that phone remotely, and that phone then becomes totally useless, where it can't be used by whoever may have found the phone or stolen it. So it would be a very difficult thing to prove if you don't have evidence that the reason why they erased the information was to avoid criminal prosecution. And we also have to remember that these are criminals that we're talking about. So obeying law isn't part of what they normally do.
But that's the key. These are criminals we're talking about. But isn't that up to a court to decide, not a police officer? And that's really the tangle for the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, but police make decisions all the time when making an arrest. And we have the authority now to search incident to an arrest. And our argument is that this is part of that search incident to an arrest. It's going to be a difficult case for the Supreme Court to sort through, but hopefully they listen to all the arguments and understand that at the time the Constitution was written and the Fourth Amendment, unlawful searches and seizures, our founding fathers did not have to deal with the technology we deal with today. There's actually an application now that's being created, if it hasn't been already, that would automatically erase all data from your phone if you simply walk into a police station. So the GPS capabilities of these phones would allow an individual to do that remotely or have it automatically done just because the suspect goes into the police station. So, I mean, the technology is advancing so fast that it's difficult to keep pace, and it's going to create some serious problems for us in the future.
Finally, Commissioner Ramsey, thinking this through with you, it sounds as though you are saying or that you have concluded that the technology has become such that the idea of prior, you know, warrant approval to searching a cell phone is obsolete, and that police should have access to a cell phone, presumed access to a cell phone in any sort of arrest situation without any consideration of a warrant, that's where the technology has led us.
The technology itself has created the exigent circumstances that we're talking about here. And it's advancing every single day. This is not an easy case, obviously, for the court. But I think that when you take all these factors into consideration, I think that they will come down with a decision that will allow us to continue to gather evidence of a crime, do so certainly within the constitutional guidelines, but understanding that with today's technology, that is becoming almost impossible to do when it comes to a smartphone. Now, if it's a regular cell phone without smartphone technology, that's different because those phones, you don't have the ability to erase automatically or remotely like you do with a smartphone. But more and more people are moving away from regular cell phones. In fact, it's probably not even that easy to buy a regular cell phone anymore. Just about everything is a smartphone. And as this technology continues to advance, it's going to become more and more difficult for us to be able to preserve evidence of a crime.
Commissioner Charles Ramsey is Philadelphia Police Commissioner and President of the Major Cities Chiefs of Police Association. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So Police Commissioner Ramsey will certainly be paying close attention to the arguments at the Supreme Court today. What is a smartphone in the annals of privacy? Is it a locked door of your house? Is it your mind? Is it the glove compartment of your car? Maybe there is no metaphor. Well, the Supreme Court will have to come up with one, perhaps, if we're going to advance the law here. Joining us is Stephen Krabari, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. Pretty tangled stuff, Professor.
Very tangled legal mess.
Is there a technological fix, or will the Supreme Court actually be motivated to do a legal fix here? Because I don't know if either one will completely solve the problem.
I don't think there's a technological fix because technology advances so fast that once you fix it, it's going to change. You're going to have to fix it again. The question that everybody wants the court to answer, I think, is, do you have an expectation of privacy in all of that data on your cell phone, and such an expectation that it would defeat the traditional approach to searching containers on a person when he or she is arrested? I think this is the question Justice Sotomayor put on the table in her opinion in Jones, her concurring opinion, when she said, Do we have to ask whether you can have a reasonable expectation of privacy in information you knowingly expose to the public? That's a remarkable question. That how can you have privacy in something you're exposing to the public? But that's kind of the reality with digital information and digital evidence.
Just to focus on that, it's exposed to privacy by simply being a part of the network, right? It's exposed to the public.
It's exposed to the public because of the way it works. Where we've all been focused on how the technology works. When you use it, it's a data stream that goes out into space and comes back. And we have to talk about it in terms of analogies because very few people have the savvy to talk about it technologically. It's not like a letter. You're not sealing something up and putting a stamp on it. It's like a postcard. All the data goes out. All the data goes around. It gets copied. It gets reassembled. It comes back. And yet you want privacy in it. Back in 1980s, Justice Stevens used the term practical obscurity in the Department of Justice versus Reporters Committee case. And that term was used by Justice Ginsburg at the D.C. Circuit when he decided the Jones GPS case, the idea being that you're so anonymous in digital communication that you have an expectation that you are practically obscure. Is that something the court ought to recognize? And it has never recognized something like that. I teach these subjects, and my students every year believe that because their data is personal and in many instances intimate, it's therefore private. And I don't think we can say the Supreme Court has ever protected the content of information. It protects where you say it, how you speak it. The seminal case was back in the 60s. A fellow named Katz goes into a phone booth, puts some money in the phone, dials it, makes a phone call. The government listens from the outside using a device attached to the outside of the phone booth. The court strikes it down, saying he closed the door. He paid for the call to eliminate everyone from the call except the person whose number he dialed. He had an expectation that his words were private from the intruding ear.
Unbelievable. If you could even find a phone booth on the streets today, that would be remarkable in and of itself. The impressions of privacy, the expectations of privacy, go before the Supreme Court in the case of smartphones. Two criminal cases being decided by the Supreme Court in arguments today. Stephen Krabari, professor of law at the University of Minnesota, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What do you think about the privacy of your cell phone? Is your impression that the government has no right to it? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So somebody apparently needs to buy a calculator over at Bank of America. B of A announced a major accounting error in reporting on its financial health to the Federal Reserve, part of the so-called bank stress test program to determine if large institutions are creeping toward insolvency, something put into place after the financial meltdown in 2009. Bank of America said it would suspend plans to buy back $4 billion in stock and would suspend an increase in its dividend, and now has 30 days to resubmit its capital plan to the Federal Reserve. Joining me now, Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor at The Guardian. Welcome back, Heidi.
It's good to be here.
The markets hated this business yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. It's confirmed all their worst fears about Bank of America since the 2009 financial crisis. You can practically hear the jokes already, too big to fail and too dumb to notice. So one of the issues is that not only did Bank of America not know that it had made this giant mistake, a $4 billion mistake, but the Federal Reserve also didn't notice it, and that's been going on for 5 years now.
Two really big issues here, and you know, big is a word that is all over this story. One is the clarity of the stress test program. It doesn't necessarily, if you pass the stress test, aside from the fact that the numbers were wrong here, I mean, you don't necessarily know what you're looking at.
Yes, exactly. The entire purpose of the stress test is almost a kind of theater to have some comfort for the security of our banks. And so there used to be an old joke when the stress test first started in 2009, when everything was really dark, that the Fed had gone from grading the banks on a pass-fail system to a simple pass-pass system, because the banks were just in such bad shape that it would be scary to know the extent of it. So what's happened since then is that the Fed judges the banks on the basis of how they would do in several scenarios: an adverse scenario, a severely adverse scenario. What happens if one of their counterparties goes out of business, as happened with AIG? And the banks figure that out themselves. They submit it to the Fed. The Fed runs the numbers on their own and sees if that's correct, and then tells the banks whether they can take some risks with the money that they have, whether they have enough money to pay back dividends or buy back shares.
It's basically all about their reserves. The Federal Reserve says you have to keep this amount of money on account to cover these sorts of losses based on this stress test.
Exactly. And that's actually sort of misleading. I mean, our entire banking system is judged by the amount of capital it keeps. Almost you can picture it like the money you have in your savings account being as a cushion. But we don't live on what's in our savings accounts, right? We live on what's in our paychecks. And banks work the same way. They work on what they borrow every single day from each other. And what we see during a financial crisis is that that's the first money to go. So the capital reserves are great. They're a nice cushion, but they won't last long if we have another scare like 2008.
And that structural issue, the stress test doesn't even really come after. So what they're passing and failing really doesn't relate to what would happen if another financial crisis would occur. Okay, that's issue number one. Issue number two involves the two ghosts of 2009, B of A's acquisition of a Countrywide, the mortgage broker, and Merrill Lynch.
Yes. This all has to do with Merrill Lynch. The reason Bank of America failed this stress test and missed its accounts by $4 billion is because of its acquisition of Merrill Lynch, which apparently it never quite figured out. So for the past 5 years, there have been these securities that came with Merrill Lynch that were supposed to protect Bank of America against a loss. And there's a system where you're supposed to mark those at the market value, right? So how much would they sell for on Tuesday? How much would they sell for on Wednesday? And it's confusing. Granted, it's confusing. It would be confusing for you and me, but it shouldn't be confusing for Bank of America. And for the past 5 years, they have accounted for those securities from Merrill Lynch incorrectly. And that is scary, because not only the persistence of the failure of accounting from that acquisition, but because Bank of America bought Countrywide, which was the nation's largest mortgage lender, and that accounting potentially has some even scarier things to come up that we may not have even heard about.
Bank of America's argument here might be, hey, look, we took a bullet for the economy, all right? Merrill Lynch was worthless. It was in flames. We acquired it. The federal government said, acquire this. We acquired Countrywide. It was virtually worthless. Look, give us a break here.
You know, a lot of banks have made that argument as well. J.P. Morgan has argued that when it bought Bear Stearns. The truth is, these banks got some very sweet deals. And in the case of Merrill Lynch specifically, Lehman Brothers was Bank of America could have bought Lehman Brothers and arguably have done even more to save the economy. But instead, it went to Merrill Lynch because it thought Merrill Lynch was a better value. So there were always moments of choice where they could, you know, exert some economic self-determination and make more profits for their shareholders. And that's the direction they went in. When they bought Countrywide, they thought they'd make money on it. They didn't think they were buying into the center of the financial crisis.
Is this a $4 billion write-down, which is probably a three-day story, or is this the beginning of a can of worms that's really going to show the nasty dark center of Bank of America over the next several months?
Yeah. Well, Bank of America is not actually going to lose any money on this because of the way accounting works. This was all basically imaginary money anyway. It's still well capitalized.
Wouldn't it be great if we could live that way?
I know,
anyway,
wouldn't it?
Continue.
So there, it's not really going to hurt the bank per se, but it does tell you a little bit about what we don't know about banks. And I think we should take that as a sobering moment. If we were to guess that everything at Bank of America was going wrong, we'd be incorrect. But it does show us that there are things that even the experts don't know, and that we should be questioning the health of the banks, even if everyone wants to convince us that they're absolutely secure, because no one can say that with definitive knowledge.
And the takeaway here, and you mentioned it just a moment ago, is that if a financial meltdown happens again in 2016, The idea that banks open some closet and, you know, cart out the money that's their reserves is really a fiction. It's all about what they borrow every day. That shuts down. We're right back to 2009.
That's exactly right. That's what brought Lehman Brothers down. It's what brought Bear Stearns down. It wasn't that they were weak financially. They weren't really. It was that no one would lend them money because they looked weak. And that's what's going to happen in the next financial crisis. So what we really need to fix is this short-term lending system that banks survive on. And nothing that's happened in the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act, nothing that's happened in any regulatory reform has changed that.
Great. I feel much better now. Heidi Moore, U.S. Finance and Economics Editor at The Guardian, talking about the $4 billion accounting error at Bank of America announced this week. Heidi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com.
A pair of looks at the nuclear age through the lens of what can go wrong in a moment, how to put a cap over Chernobyl after that 1986 meltdown that has become a deeper symbol of the disturbing history between Russia and Ukraine. But first, the Retro Report documentary team takes us back to a familiar name that America learned about, a place near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, from news reports back in 1979.
An accident at the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant, which is located on an island in the Susquehanna River, 10 miles from Harrisburg.
The cooling system broke down this morning. Some radioactive steam escaped into the air. Radiation was detected a mile away from the plant.
The technical experts tell you there's got to be something wrong with the meters. Got to be not working properly. Well, it turned out the meters were right. The idea of the men in white lab coats were supposed to know, and they're standing there scratching their heads. That, I think, shook the public.
That voice there is Victor Galinsky, then head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, remembering just how badly the confidence of the public was shaken after Three Mile Island. Kit Roan, Retro Report producer, joins me now. Kit, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the images of nuclear power were really tossed and stirred up by Three Mile Island. What happened?
Well, in the Three Mile Island accident, there was a cooling system breakdown, and that kind of led to a cascade of problems that people didn't understand.
And a physicist and historian you talked with, Spencer Wirt, describes that what was stirred up in Americans and really people across the world were some of their deepest fears.
The complex of images around nuclear power is quite unique. There's nothing outside religious imagery that is so strong, so pervasive, and involves so many hooks.
Nuclear energy isn't waiting to help people everywhere in some brave new world of the future. The peaceful atom is here now.
Nuclear scientists had all kinds of visions of the new society. Energy would be practically free. We'd have nuclear-powered flying cars. The deserts would be conquered. We'd build cities in the Arctic wastes. It was an explosion of wonderful ideas about how things could be improved.
Historian Spencer Wirt there really describing how Three Mile Island put to rest those utopian ideas of nuclear power, making the world perfect in the 20th, 21st century.
Yes. I mean, I think Wirt is very good at sort of noting how nuclear energy connects with people in many different levels and it hits all of these different hooks. And it has these, he mentions that it has these religious overtones associated with it, that it's kind of, seen as this not just something that can constructor of new worlds, but also a destroyer of them. And it's a very powerful energy source compared to other sources.
Has Three Mile Island vanished in the historical memory for the generation today?
I think that's what you find, particularly with one of the interviews we did with Michael Schellenberger. He notes that his reference point for Three Mile Island is a skit on Saturday Night Live.
Three Mile Island looks so long ago to millennials. It's sort of something that your parents talk about and worry about. And I remember the Saturday Night Live skit where Jimmy Carter goes into the reactor to try to save it.
Mr. President, you're glowing.
Jimmy!
Don't touch me. I'm a nuclear engineer and I'm pretty worried right now.
He turns into this gigantic, radiated man. And it all seems sort of exaggerated. The concerns that young environmentalists have are overwhelmingly around living in a hotter world, and that those pretty seriously outweigh their concerns around nuclear.
Is that a delusion that Michael Schellenberger is talking about there, that the Three Mile Island really isn't a concern, and that when we look at Fukushima, We can see that nuclear power is as troublesome and challenging as it's ever been.
Nuclear experts will tell you that nobody died at Three Mile Island, but you know, critics will point out that it's not just about deaths, it's also just about the destruction, economic and otherwise. And in Chernobyl, you still have 1,000 square miles that are off limits and towns of 45,000 people that are desolate. There's a reason why private investors are not sort of lining up to fund nuclear power plants. It's because when things go wrong, they're very, very expensive to, the problems are very expensive to deal with and they're very expensive to clean up.
The Lessons of 3 Mile Island. Kit Roan is a Retro Report producer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Less than a decade after 3 Mile Island, it was the name Chernobyl that would come to symbolize the potential horrors associated with nuclear energy. A town in Ukraine with a graphic core nuclear reactor, number 4, went into full meltdown and exploded. The place is still a nuclear disaster exclusion zone where workers quietly clean up this legacy of Russia's relationship with now independent Ukraine. One aspect of that cleanup can be seen in the nearby town of Slavutich, where a 220-person team is working to build a 32,000-ton arch that will cover the sarcophagus and seal the radioactive remains from that 1986 explosion. It's a $1.5 billion project, the completion date now threatened by instability in the region. Joining me now is Lauren Dodd, who spent 8 years as the managing director of the project before returning from Ukraine to the U.S. a few weeks ago. Lauren, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much, John.
Why did the U.S. cooperate on this, and how complicated is this effort to seal Chernobyl by the current political instability?
Well, the U.S. cooperated. The history is that, of course, the accident happened in 1986. In 1991, the Soviet Union broke up. And right after that, there became increasing international concern about the safety of Chernobyl-style reactors. And in 1995, the G7 countries signed an agreement with the government of Ukraine that they would close down the remaining operating units at Chernobyl in exchange for an international assistance program to put the damaged reactor into an environmentally sound condition. And that's how the U.S. got involved.
Lauren Dodd, your career pretty much spans the history of nuclear energy and the Cold War. You began at NREACTOR in Washington State. That's my old stomping ground as a reporter. The Cold War and nuclear energy, are you helping to put that to rest by managing this project for the last 8 years?
Well, I've never thought of it quite that way, but I guess that I am. We had the opportunity in the early 90s to work with the former Soviet Union, Russia, and Ukraine, and 6 other countries to improve the safety of their operating reactors. And I think that was a good outcome of the end of the Cold War, because I think that throughout that region, the reactors are in certainly better shape today than they were in the 1990-91 timeframe.
Tell me about this cap. Tell me about this cap you're going to put over the sarcophagus at Chernobyl.
You know, this is kind of the culmination of the program that my company, Bechtel, and I have been working on since 1998. And what we're doing is putting a new safe confinement, is what we're calling it, over the existing sarcophagus. And this new safe confinement has been designed to last for 100 years, and it serves several purposes. First of all, it'll prevent any more radioactive dust and aerosols from escaping from the reactor and from the object shelter today, which continues to be a problem. The second purpose that it'll address is it'll provide an environment for removing unstable structures in the old sarcophagus and the old reactor. And then finally, it'll provide an opportunity for Ukraine over the next 100 years to remove the fuel-containing masses and put them into some kind of long-term storage.
Well, your 100-year plan may be updated by the political fragility in the region. How worried are you about the political instability between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think, we're all worried about the instability in Ukraine today for lots of reasons. However, with regard to this specific project, it's really had no impact on us to date. Slavutich and the Chernobyl nuclear power plant are located about 2.5 hours north of Kiev near the Belarusian border. And it's probably the most stable part of Ukraine today. When I left there in the middle of March, basically, we could see no impact at all, either in Slavutich or on site. So what we knew about what was going on was just what we read in the press and so on. And today, the construction of the project has not suffered at all as a result of the instability. And we hope it continues that way. I think one of the concerns I personally have is the Ukrainian staff. And I think, you know, emotionally, you know, they're all very worried about what the situation is.
We're glad to hear that the impact has been minimal, but going forward, a lot of questions. Lauren Dodd managed the ARCH project at Chernobyl for the last 8 years as a senior employee at Bechtel. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, John.
Another round of non-nuclear confrontation between the West and Russia over the territory of Ukraine, admitting the failure of a more than week-old diplomatic initiative to achieve a de-escalation in the crisis on eastern Ukraine, President Obama announced new sanctions against Russian politicians and companies close to President Vladimir Putin. The apparent strategy here is to exploit Russia's ties to the international banking system by making people Putin allegedly depends on politically feel the financial pain of sanctions. But Putin may not need the rich as badly as the West thinks if the Russian leader has the Russian people in his pocket, politically speaking. Thomas Graham served on the National Security Council from 2004 to 2007 as the senior director for Russia. He's now a senior fellow at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Thomas Graham, welcome.
Glad to be here.
So sanctions are supposed to sting people around Vladimir Putin. I presume we're talking about oligarchs and people involved in state-owned enterprises who need access to the banking system. Is that a good strategy?
I don't think so. And part of this, I think, is it's a miscalculation of what drives Putin. The assumption here is that money is the most important thing, that if you create some financial pain, particularly around people close to Putin, that he's going to step back and say, "Ooh, wait a minute, this is not what I need to do. I need to come to some sort of deal with the United States, the West, and Kiev on Ukraine." But Putin is really driven by something else. This is a man who for the past 14 years has focused on rebuilding Russia, reasserting its role in world affairs. Ukraine is important because of the national security implications for that. This is a man that's prepared to accept some economic pain to achieve a greater goal for Russia.
Is Russia moving towards isolation in the sense that Putin believes he can rebuild Russia with funds obtained from selling his own fossil fuel resources and that he doesn't necessarily need the international banking system as much as President Obama thinks?
Well, when he looks at the world today, he doesn't see simply the United States and Europe. He sees China. He sees India. He sees Brazil. He sees other options that he can turn to that will, in a sense, alleviate the pain that might be caused by the United States. I think that's something that we need to think about. It's difficult to isolate a country like Russia, the sixth largest economy in the world, that in fact does have other options at this point.
What are those other options? What do they look like, if not isolation?
Russia sends a lot of its gas to Europe. But one of the things that they've been trying to do over the past several years, in which they will focus on the future, is delivering a lot of that gas into Asia. Rapidly growing market. China has an insatiable desire for energy. So they've got options in Asia that they can use to turn away from Europe. If you're thinking about investment, a lot of the investment previously would have come from the United States. But there are pockets of money now in Asia that you can use to develop some of these resources. So the point is Putin has other options than the West, which is a big change from, say, where the situation was 15 or 20 years ago.
Short of completely ignoring the sanctions and sort of rhetorically saying, give me your best shot, I don't care, what is it that Putin can do that would demonstrate to the world clearly that the sting of the sanctions is not as great as the West would hope?
Well, Europe depends on Russia for about a quarter of its gas. Some countries, 100%. Germany, about a third of its gas. Russia can threatened to cut that off or to delay the delivery in some way. So there are other things that Russia could do as well along those lines to indicate that there is some pain to be paid in the West if the United States and the European Union continues to go down this route.
What is the pain threshold then? What could he do early to maybe shut down the sanctions and end it right here? Flip the switch on Germany?
Well, you could do something like that or threaten something like that. But this isn't going to end quickly. This is a confrontation over the future of Ukraine, very important for Russia. They believe for historical reasons that having a friendly Ukraine is critical to their own security. So they're prepared to pay a high price.
So if military is off the table and sanctions, as you suggest, are strategically misguided and just don't work— It's the West that's out of options.
Well, we're not out of options because you can always negotiate. We have two goals in this current crisis. The first goal is to try to stabilize eastern Ukraine, deter Russia from further military incursions into Ukraine. The second is to defend the rules of European order, which Russia violated by seizing Crimea. So what I've argued for is what I would call a combination of focused resistance plus considered accommodation of Russian interest. So you've seen some of the focused resistance in our effort to reassure our allies in eastern Europe, Poland and the Baltic states particularly, through military exercises, air patrol, some contingency planning. NATO also needs to begin to rebuild its military capabilities to demonstrate that we're prepared to honor our Article 5 guarantees of collective defense in Europe. Then you have to accommodate Russia's interests. Now, I think what we've lost sight of in the current debate over sanctions and so forth is the problem in Ukraine. Ukraine is broken. The state has collapsed. There's not national unity. The economy is teetering on the brink of ruin. So Ukraine needs to rebuild its state. It needs to forge a national consensus. It needs to repair its economy. The hard truth is we can't do that without Russia. Russia provides the overwhelming bulk of Ukraine's oil and gas. It's an important market for Ukraine. And as we've already talked, it has a lot of personal ties, historical ties, that give it leverage over what happens inside Ukraine. So the challenge for the United States and the European Union is to find a way to bring this to a negotiation, talk about those issues of Russian language rights, decentralization, non-bloc status for Ukraine as a way of accommodating, as we need to, some of Russia's interest in bringing this crisis hopefully to a positive end.
I'm listening intently to what you're saying. It sounds like in that negotiation that you envision, territory will be on the table.
I don't think so. The key for Putin is really the geopolitical orientation of Ukraine. What he's trying to do, in my mind, is to use the rebellion in eastern Ukraine as a way of gaining leverage over the structure of the Ukrainian state, the formation of the government, so that he has, as I said before, a Ukraine that is not hostile to Russia. The idea being that over time you can gradually bring a more or less unified Ukraine into what he hopes to build, which is a Eurasian Union.
Thomas Graham, Senior Fellow at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com.
Is there a plantation mentality in the NBA? This is the national conversation that has erupted now that the owner of the LA Clippers has been allegedly heard in a recording making racist comments about African Americans. As an employer of African Americans, including the Clippers coach Doc Rivers, does owner Donald Sterling believe he is permitted to think of blacks in derogatory racist terms? The allegations will be the subject of a news conference by the NBA later today, where Commissioner Adam Silver is challenged to get the NBA in the middle of the playoffs past a scandal that has already lost millions in sponsorships for the LA Clippers and has fans talking about a playoff broadcast and spectator boycott. Fans like Eric Weaver and a few other voices heard on the streets this week of New York City.
As a fan, I think that if you have any morals, you shouldn't support the LA Clippers as long as Donald Sterling owns the team. The only thing that would hurt him is no money. I mean, it's a sad thing that, you know, still in 2014, racism is still alive and well, but this is America and the world we live in.
I would like to see him like kind of just like taken out of the picture altogether. Maybe someone will buy out the team. I'm not really sure. But I think the players, it's a fine line. Like, they have to respect him as an owner, but it's absolutely ridiculous that he's allowed to make comments like that and stay.
The players should just keep making money and just don't worry about that. You know what I mean? So it should, the whole entire organization shouldn't suffer because of one person's ignorance.
Three views from three fans here in New York City, Eric Weaver, Shannon Brewer, and Ty Pinnick. What can the NBA do here with that sort of sentiment floating around? Mike Finkelstein is a professor of sports marketing and management at Rutgers University. Welcome, Professor.
Hello, John.
Also with me is Harvey Schiller, chairman of the Schiller Management Group, a consulting firm that works with big clients in the sports broadcasting industry. Harvey Schiller, welcome.
Hey, thank you.
So, Mike, what does the NBA do here to move past this? And is it simply a matter of surgically removing Mr. Sterling?
Well, John, it's an interesting dilemma. Obviously, we're faced with just horrible commentary and horrible thinking. I actually don't espouse the striking method. I think that hurts everybody and takes away from the art and excellence that these players have worked so hard for all their lives. And it deprives the people who are really coming to enjoy that entertainment of seeing that art. I'm hoping that within the bylaws and constitution of the NBA, there is the ability to certainly remove or suspend Mr. Sterling. And one of the thoughts that I had while reading all these commentaries was the idea that in looking at the longest contracts, which I believe are Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, that go through the 17-18 season, we might consider suspending him and eliminating him from the team through that point. At that point, the longest serving contract and all players before then will have the right themselves to decide, do they want to play for this man? Is there any contrition? Has he, you know, proved to the public that this was an aberration, which seems doubtful based on his history? But that way, it will put the power in the hands of the players and allow them to perform their art.
So suspend Sterling the length of the longest contract there on the L.A. Clippers and allow anyone else to decide whether they want to stay with the Clippers or not. That's Mike Finkelstein, professor of sports marketing and management at Rutgers University. Harvey Schiller, what do you think the NBA can do to move past this?
Well, I think there's obviously been a number of conversations from the old guard, the other owners, you know, the Lakers, the White, the Bulls, and so forth. And I think they've all had the conversation because every member of the NBA would be harmed in going forward with the ownership that they have now. And interestingly, I attended the final going away party for former Commissioner David Stern, and Adam Silver, the new commissioner, gave out bracelets to everyone, and the bracelets had on it WWDS, and it was, what would David say? What would the old commissioner say? I'm sure that even former Commissioner Stern's been on the phone, and my prediction is that by this afternoon there'll be an announcement that Mr. Sterling is going to remove himself from the team, and the team will be up for sale. That's what I would guess would happen.
Let's talk about the broad history here. And Stern has a reputation as an extraordinary innovator in all aspects of the NBA, including, welcoming African Americans and really, putting them in prominence all throughout the NBA. But is there, going back in history and looking at all of sports in the United States, a plantation mentality in that ownership kind of can have its way about racism, about the way it treats its employees, and doesn't really have to be a role model in the way that sports folks, players on the field have to be? Harvey Schiller?
Well, there's no question that that attitude prevailed for a very long time. I mean, we only have to go back to people like Jackie Robinson and others to understand how they were looked upon when they entered professional sports. In some cases, it continues today. It certainly continues on a global basis. If you read about what happens in the sport of football, soccer, internationally, how different African-American players and others have bananas thrown at them and other things. So I think it's not gone, and I think it's up to all of us to continue to not tolerate the kind of behavior that we're seeing happen right now in the case of the Clippers.
Mike Finkelstein, what do you think about this notion of a historical legacy of a plantation mentality in American sports and in the NBA?
Well, I agree with Harvey. There's a reality that this has, you know, pervaded our leagues for many, many years. I think there are just only a few individuals, certainly in our professional leagues, that may behave like this. But I would like to believe, and I do believe, that the United States still is the leader in the sports business world. And in that role, we really, really need to set the tone. And I believe, you know, in the meetings that I have, that we live in a world that is very diverse and very accepting and colorblind, genderblind. There's still a long way to go. We really, really need to improve on this, but I believe that everybody realizes this is a absolute necessity.
Easy for us to say, but Mike Finkelstein, you know, what would you do if you were Doc Rivers or one of those players on the Clippers? What would you do?
I'd be my very, very best. I would be the most excellent I can be in anything that I choose to do. And I believe Doc Rivers probably believes this from what I've read. He's never a victim. He's always responsible. Those people have chosen to be in the Clippers in this particular instance. They have a vehicle to exhibit their extraordinary talents and to be the leaders that they are, and to guide us and to be the very best they can be.
Well, those talents will be on display as the Clippers meet Golden State once again right here in the playoffs at the center of this controversy. Mike Finkelstein, professor of sports marketing and management at Rutgers, and Harvey Schiller, chairman of the Schiller Management Group. Thanks, Harvey and Mike.
Thank you so much.
So we're going to hear from the NBA today, but we want to hear from you long before that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Do you think the players should sit out tonight's games? What about the fans? You can take our survey at thetakeaway.org to tell us what you think. And call us again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. When have you experienced a plantation mentality anywhere in your life? Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com, with tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. Help is available at 1-800-REPUTATION or at Reputation.com. TiVo, delivering cable TV and internet TV together in one searchable and unified viewing experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.